Today on Vox Talks Economics, the lost promises of COP26. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram as well. Now, this summer, Vox Talks is bringing you interviews from CPR's Paris Symposium. And Paris is, of course, the place where the agreement to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees was struck in 2015. But what chance for that now? Sanctions against Russia have sent the price of oil and gas rocketing, triggering more, not less, fossil fuel extraction. Many politicians are under pressure over the cost of fuel and heating. What's going to be the impact on climate policy? Well, I'm joined by Marc Rouen of Northwestern University and Rick van der Ploeg of the University of Oxford. Marc, welcome.
Hello, Tim.
And Rick, good to see you too.
Hi, Tim.
Rick, we sort of assume that initiatives like Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, that was something that was launched at COP26, they're reducing fossil fuel extraction. But recently, we saw Energy Policy publishing an article with 425 fossil fuel projects. They're called carbon bombs. This is a very emotive name for them. What are they?
Well, they're basically new projects by gas and oil majors to invest in new exploration and to invest in new oil and gas stuff. And that's really weird because we have about 6 or 7 years to go at current emissions, and then we go overshoot the 1.5 degree target. You know, there's very little time left. There's a sense of urgency. It's almost 1 to 12, or I even think 1 past 12. And then really, we should lock all the stuff in the ground, particularly the coal, the oil and the gas. Then if these big oil companies see themselves as cash machines, particularly because the gas and oil prices are rocketing up, they've been investing like hell, secretly sometimes, in huge projects, basically allowing for an extra 18 years of burning fossil fuel at the rate we're doing. So that alone is already overshooting the amount that we're allowed to burn if we want to stay below 1.5 degrees by a factor 6 or 7.
So to be clear, these are not just legacy projects that haven't been shut down yet. This is new exploration.
They come on top of the legacy projects because there have been previous studies published also in journals like Nature, and they show that if you go and look at all the annual reports of the Shell, the BP, ExxonMobil, and all those stuff, and they add up all their reserves. And these are not probable reserves, the reserve they got ready to take out. And then you compare them with the carbon budget, how much we're allowed to burn, about 300 gigatons. Then that's a factor already 8 times too high. So they're adding on top of that. Yeah. So that means that there's two things that you can say about it. It's either that they think climate policy is not credible. Well, I would probably agree with them because we've had very, very little success on it so far. Yeah. So it's really an indictment of the fact that we've not done our best enough. Or secondly, that these companies are terribly overvalued. You could call it a green paradox in the sense that they're really pumping like hell whilst the music is going. They know at some point policymakers will have to act and stand up and do something about the climate thing. Probably it's too late, but for them it means that it's end of business for them. So they're probably now pumping like hell and trying to invest as much whilst they can still get away with it. But it's scandalous and it's immoral.
I was looking up the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance that I quoted. It's got had 8 national or subnational governments that were backing it when it launched. It's got 8 now, none of the big oil producers. It doesn't seem that there's any commitment to shutting down these carbon bombs from government at the moment. Like you see, there's nothing we can really do about it.
So we must realize it's not just the usual suspects. It's not just the Gulf states. It's not just Russia, who of course is pumping to find this disgusting war. But it's also the United States, it's Canada, and it's Australia. And it's not just gas and oil, it's also coal. And even the UK, where I normally live, there's suddenly people are thinking, well, shale gas, maybe not such a bad idea after all. And of course, all that stuff would just add to extra emissions and would add to the fragility of the climate. It's just bloody dangerous, so we shouldn't be having it.
In more recent news, clearly, we have the effects of the war in Ukraine. And the first thing you heard when there was the threat to oil and gas supplies in Europe were European leaders saying we really must wean ourselves off our dependency on fossil fuels. Has that been backed up by any action that we've seen yet?
Not really, unfortunately. So there was some initial hope that this dramatic crisis would be used to take some dramatic action, which is clearly needed. But instead, what we have seen is that they have subsidized demand via subsidies to the consumption of fossil fuels. They have continued to buy oil and gas to Russia, which is clearly a way to finance the war. And they are already planning investments that will ensure our dependence on fossil fuels for many, many years to come. So that initial instinct that was in the right place was quickly banished with measures that do nothing to fix the climate problem and honestly do nothing to make our dependence from fossil fuels less bad. We will be dependent on fossil fuels from a different person.
And we're seeing these reversal of stated policies, aren't we? And new projects being green lit by governments. I mean, just just recently in the North Sea, we have the Jackdaw gas field has been approved, the UK government, and Joe Biden, when he was standing for election, said there would be no drilling on federal lands ever. And now they are selling the licenses to drill on federal lands. It really is remarkable how quickly these policies have turned around.
It is unfortunate. It's frustrating. Joe Biden, the climate president. I'm still laughing. So it is in some ways not surprising that they will go to the easiest path of action, but it is deeply frustrating. I have to say we can blame the Ukraine war for this, but this was already happening before because energy prices had been rising before the war.
Mm-hmm.
And even without the war, they were already chickening on many of these policies. So the war hasn't changed that discourse. They were already backing down from many commitments. And the war doesn't seem a big enough of a shock to reflect and change course of action.
It's even worse in a way because you think all these spiraling gas and energy prices is great. It will accelerate a green transition.
Mm-hmm.
But then what countries throughout Europe have been doing, have been trying to lower the gas price, which is, of course, like a direct present to Putin to finance his war machinery. Of course, you should help poor people, but not by lowering the gas prices. These are incentives. They are strong signals to move to a green transition. But you should just give cash to poor families so they can cope with their energy bills, but not screw around with the price mechanism. And I think that's what's happened. So you see this double whammy. So you get all these carbon bombs. You get the governments approving those carbon bombs. And at the same time, climate policy is not really being implemented. And if anything is implemented, it's done in a perverse way. So it's all that together. Yeah, it's a fairly dire situation for the environment.
Even before the war, there were very worrisome signs in this direction. When the EU claimed that natural gas was green, that was not just atrocious from the optics of it. They were paving the way to funneling public money to natural gas. There had been a bit of a movement to challenge new natural gas investments with public funding because they go clearly against the stated goals of the European Union to obey to these pledges. But that kind of way of challenging these new investments is gone the minute that you claim that this thing is green.
Yeah, it's related to the fact that that same report that you started off with, Tim, also makes the case, which is the economists know, and the IMF has done many studies on that, that exactly those countries with all these pension bombs like the United States, Australia, Canada, are those countries with the highest fossil fuel subsidies. Globally, fossil fuel subsidies are about 7% of world GDP. Now think about it. It's completely tipsy-turvy. We should be taxing that and we should be subsidizing renewables. The subsidies for renewable energies are nothing. It's almost peanuts. It's nothing compared with the subsidies for the dirty stuff. It's really the wrong way around. So when Greta Thunberg comes on and she's laughed at when she says, oh, it's all blah, blah, she's actually completely right. She's put her finger on the spot.
Those politicians that don't like her speaking in democratic countries, they're faced now with a rising cost of living,
of course,
inflation, the cost of fuel is going up, people are worrying about heating their homes. When you talk about policies like carbon taxes, it's politically not feasible for them to implement them at the moment, surely.
I had some colleagues in the US who felt that the low gasoline prices were good for the climate. And I'm like, can you explain me this again? And they go like, well, this will keep Biden in power. And I'm like, well, what is Biden doing about the climate? Because I don't think he's doing much. So there is this fallacy that we need to keep fossil fuels cheap so that we can do climate policy. I honestly don't buy it. There's also this optionality that is given in this discourse. We have the option to maybe care about climate policy, but this is not consistent with the facts. We need to take it as given that we need to curb our emissions and hopefully go to somehow to zero. Hopefully. But at the very least, we need to take that commitment seriously. And if we put always as an excuse that we will no longer be in power, well, then we will not do anything while we're in power, and then we'll not do anything when we are not in power, clearly.
So I think the economic arguments are well known. politicians know that if they delay it by another 5 years, it's going to be much, much more expensive to achieve the same targets, or that you may even be able to make the same targets. So you need very courageous politicians. So what's now happening is a movement of lawyers. So activists who take governments to court, of course, it's happened in the Netherlands, and they say, look, you've committed to those and those things, but you're not doing anything about it. Now we are forcing you to do it. And they're getting their right in the court. The same thing, Shell has been taken to court about the CO2 targets, and they've been told to get their books in order. So I think that route is going to be an extremely important route. Just by saying, look, this is the policies you have to do is not enough. You need to actually make it a bit tougher. And politicians need to know that if they screw up now, and it has to be done in 5 or 10 years' time. Now, what is then their legacy? Sometimes being a politician requires to take bold and long-run decisions. That's what distinguishes a bad from a good politician.
The good thing about this that will make it, unfortunately, easier is that climate is no longer in the future, in some decades. It's happening in real time. So the political cycle and the climate impacts are now in sync. Mm-hmm. And a politician can no longer afford to bullshit, if I may, about this, and then claim that they didn't see it coming, which was true 20 years ago.
So the IPCC report, which was presented in Glasgow, shows that there's an enormous increased frequency of extreme weather events. Hurricanes, you name it, extreme droughts and things like that. So politicians are going to be faced with that. What Mar says is that they are going to be forced to take action. But it's better to take action now and even run up a government debt if you need to do it. If they wait 5, 10 years, it's going to be much more expensive. So it's better to do it now. And you can spare current generations by running up debt temporarily if you're doing that, because you're doing something about the future. Because if you wait, then people are going to really point a finger at you that you've made a mess of it.
You talked about lawyers taking these companies to court. I deal quite a lot with people in the finance industry, and they make a case that shareholder pressure will influence the decision making of these companies. Well, that doesn't seem to be very apparent at the moment, does it? Is that really a curb on their behavior?
I mean, there have been some cases in which marginally they can influence some of the decisions, but we need to keep in mind that to fix the climate problem, we need to make fossil fuels irrelevant. So that amount of value extraction, which is sizable, I don't think it can be done eternally by the same firms that you are trying to make irrelevant.
You can't discuss with the Turkish you're going to slaughter for Christmas how they want to be cooked. That's really the story with these fossil fuel companies. But there are some positive things. I mean, there are lots of tipping points that can be set in motion. And the main problem, I mean, gas and oil are already more expensive than wind or solar. But the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time. So you need huge investments in storage. So people talk about hydrogen, but green hydrogen, which is made from wind power, is much too expensive yet. But for example, you're from Spain. Why not have huge wind power and solar power farms in Spain? But then you need interconnectors to get it to the industrial areas of Europe. I don't see any action on that coming from Europe. The way to solve the problem is to solve the intermittence problems for renewable energies, then you can use it. To solve the intermittence problems, you need storage. We don't have mountains with lakes like in Norway, well, some of them, but we need to get where you're going to produce, maybe in Africa or in Spain, you're going to produce a solar energy or the wind energy on the sea, and then you have to find interconnectors to send it to where all the stuff is. Otherwise, you can shut down all your steel factories and shut down all your cement factories, your aluminium factories. It's end of business. Mm-hmm. But politicians are never going to do that. So you have to find a route to do it, and that's to solve the storage problem. That's the biggest thing.
Yes, and there's been a lot of innovation going into storage solutions. So when people think about the storage, they think about batteries, and in the narrative, in the media, it really, they will spin it as batteries are atrocious for the planet too, so why not keep being atrocious with a planet with fossil fuels? But there's been a lot of investigation in storage solutions that are lean in resources. So gravity is kind of the best storage solution that will be lean in resources, because gravity just happens to be there. So water, you can bring it up and then let it fall. There are also innovation coming with other materials that are not water, given, for example, that in Spain, water is scarce, but sun is plentiful. In terms of interconnectors, also lots of innovation coming with direct current lines that can go underground, with obviously from a not in my backyard point of view, much easier to place. They can go through the sea, also from a not in my backyard point of view, way easier to place. So there are some innovations that honestly make renewables a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. So not only is environmentally irresponsible that EU governments will be planning on new investment in LNG that will bring even more loads of natural gas that we cannot afford to burn from an environmental point of view, it's also, in my opinion, economically irresponsible. We are learning from this crisis that, again, preceded the war, natural gas prices were already very high before the war, we are learning from the crisis that fossil fuels might not be as reliable as we think. And yes, maybe renewables are intermittent, but I can tell you the sun will come out. Hopefully it will come out tomorrow.
So I completely agree. But the only little proviso, now we have a geopolitical dependence in Europe, it's my Dutch side speaking, on Russia. What will happen, this is a recent White House report, and it shows that 60-70% of the world's rare metals are under control of China. If it's not going to be up a mountain, or if it's not going to be hydrogen, you're going to be, all the batteries require those rare metals. Then you become dependent on China. So that's almost just as bad as being dependent on Russia from my book. So the challenge is to find storage facilities, renewable energy technologies that don't make you geopolitically dependent and that don't have this huge pollution. Because everywhere you have these rare metals, they're being mined. All the people around it, high incidence of cancer and things like that. So we want to avoid that. There's a reason why Greenland says no thank you to those rare metal mining stuff. So we need to think much more as environmental economists, but also as politicians very much about 10, 20 years ahead when we will have moved to renewable energy. That we move to the right type of renewable energies.
So this is why I'm so optimistic about these lean battery technologies that are much less invasive and readily available in almost any climate, any type of geography. I think we also need to admit that we are not trying to substitute fossil fuels with renewables and avoid any kind of reflection on our use of energy. So if renewables are available at some times of the day, not others, we might well need to change how we as consumers use energy, when we use it, why we use it. So I do think that the broader solution does involve also some self-reflection, not just on the supply side, but also on the demand side. So what are we as consumers doing about this, and how can we make the storage problem less difficult?
But I've heard around this conference many people worrying that the current crisis and the need to be able to provide fuel, heating, manageable cost of living for European countries means at the moment the EU has to put aside its climate goals. And it has a big plan, but it has to de-emphasize that. All your optimism, if it's not backed by political momentum, means that those goals will not be met.
This is the discourse that I honestly completely do not buy. I don't see a trade-off here. So if we need energy because winter is coming and it will not be a great winter, let's say it, the cheapest way to do it is with renewables. So there is obviously an interest that it sounds like there is a conflict in these goals. But I honestly, from an economic point of view, let alone an environmental point of view, but a purely economical point of view, I do not see a conflict between these goals.
I mean, you could argue, never waste a crisis. That's a familiar argument. For example, in the Netherlands again, then they have gas reserves. And who owns the gas reserve stations? The Russians. So they're completely dependent. So they can't even cover the period. So what's the best thing to do? Is go green. It's got geopolitical advantages. It will have economic advantages in the long run. And the quicker you do it, the cheaper it is. So don't waste the crisis. Go for it as quick as possible.
Let's hope the policymakers are listening. Thank you very much, both of you, for talking to me today.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
This has been a Vox Talk recorded live at CPR Paris Symposium 2022. Every week we bring you the most important latest research, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe, you'll find more than 200 episodes. So whatever type of economics you like, there is a Vox Talk waiting for you.